In this week's programme, a study of the views of Conor Cruise O'Brien by the historian Dermot Whelan, who died in 2010 and taught international politics at the School of History in University College Cork. In his book Conor Cruise O'Brien, Violent Notions, Dr. Whelan points to a man of many contradictions, rebel and loyalist, exponent of both cold reason and deep emotion. But there is a core to the man, he argues, and that is his view that legitimacy, stability and order are truly paramount to society. The author examines O'Brien's intellectual influences, and these range from his mother's Catholic nationalism to his father's secular liberalism, from Owen Sheehy Skeffington to Sean O'Fialloyne and Albert Camus. As to O'Brien's legacy, he suggests that he had an influence on the mindset of late 20th century Ireland comparable to that of Pierce and De Valera. Here is Conor Cruise O'Brien speaking after he'd just taken up a new position with the Observer newspaper as editor-in-chief.
I think, in a sense, an intellectual in politics is either something of an anti-politician. That's to say, he gets involved in the critique of the actual political context in which he finds himself, which is a rather dangerous activity, I agree, though I think possibly sometimes a useful one. Or he succumbs to that context and ceases to be an intellectual and becomes a politician pure and simple, as some of, for example, the intellectuals in the court of John Kennedy did. I think I took the first course rather than the second, and I'm glad of that.
Conor Cruise O'Brien speaking in a television interview with John Bowman in 1979. With me, Ronan Fanning, Emeritus Professor of History at UCD, and Michael D. Higgins, President of the Labour Party and former Minister for Communications. Ronan, how did you assess this book? What did you make of it?
I was very impressed with it. I never knew Dermot Whelan. He was only 37 years of age when he died, and I think he's a great loss, because there are very few books, in my view, which are as dispassionate and as analytical and as intellectually honest in dealing with issues which are very neuralgic. And I think, for just to give you an example, that quotation that we just heard from Conor Cruise O'Brien about the intellectual in politics, I think it brings out very well something that Dermot Whelan speaks about in the book. And he identifies his increasing fondness for polar opposites. And I think he was somebody, Conor Cruise O'Brien, who was happiest when he was seeing things in terms of black and white. There were the good guys, there were the bad guys, there were the cowboys, there were the Indians. And it's very interesting. I mean, I think what he said there in that quotation was frankly nonsense, that, you know, because I think to say that a politician, because he's remains a politician and doesn't opt out of politics, is in some way behaving in an anti-intellectual way or is incapable of being intellectual, I just think that's plain wrong.
Michael Higgins, what did you think of the book overall?
Well, I very much like this book, and I like it for many of the reasons that Ronan says. But in addition to, I think it's multidisciplinary reach, because he was able to handle the literary influences on Conor Cruise O'Brien, as well as the political ones. And, you know, the book is a beautiful book. It would have been worth it alone for the chapter on Antigone, for example. And I think, as well, when you look at the references in it that he draws from, like Maurice Goldring and so forth, and I thought it a lovely book in terms of, as well, its ability to handle uncertainty, because the commentaries on Conor Cruise O'Brien have tended to put him into categories that are not easily filled. And I think that, if you like, the shifting grounds of Conor Cruise O'Brien's position, for example, from the very early, including through a period of nationalism and republicanism, onto his extraordinarily, I think, unwise writings in the end on Israel and the Middle East, where I think he, in fact, loses intellectual rigour.
His thinking around on Northern Ireland, I mean, Whelan makes much of the fact that he changed his mind between 67 and 72, that Before that, he thought of the North and its problems in terms of many causes. Eventually, he settled for religion and then nationalism after that. But there was a kind of a narrowing of focus there.
Well, I think it's even more stark than that, because if you look at what he's doing in the 1950s, when he's one of the, I mean, one of his great strengths was his extraordinary fluency and his extraordinary ability with words. I mean, he wrote extraordinarily well. And during the 1950s, he's one of the great anti-partition propagandists, probably the most significant one in the Department of Foreign Affairs. And there are some quotations in the book, which Whelan has found a quotation from the 1950s, and another quotation from 1994. And they are literally polar opposites of each other. You know, on the one hand, he's saying partition is all the fault of the British, it's evil, so on and so forth in the 1950s. And then in 1995, he joins the United Kingdom Unionist Party.
Yeah.
And there's a devastating contrast between those quotations. I think one of the things is that he also describes them as a writer who's a creature of his temperament. I think that's a very interesting
Just to stay on the change of mind, Michael D., I mean, do you see a pattern to that trajectory? Was there something happening, taking all the way, as Ronan said, from the beginning, being a polemical anti-partitionist to somebody joining the Unionist Party?
Well, I knew Conor Cruise O'Brien, you see, in different ways. I encountered him as a very warm, gracious man. On occasion, I was in hospital briefly when States of Ireland came out. He visited me. He gave me a copy of the book. And I was impertinent enough to offer opinions on parts of it that I thought were missing, such as, for example, Conor is an academic that comes out of a historical literary setting, but the social sciences, such as sociology or so forth, would be new to him, so he just chose to ignore them.
Yes, yeah.
And I remember pointing that out to him. But may I say that what is striking in the book, and that what Dermot Whelan did catch very well, is what I feel is the almost unavoidable depression of rationality and intellectual life itself. I remember when Conor Cruise O'Brien is in his New York period and he's meeting Chomsky and Hannah Arendt, there's a lot of Hannah Arendt in it, insofar as that there is an intellectual restlessness in it. And I think that to some extent, in the first half of the book, which deals with Conor Cruise O'Brien, the influences of his father, mother, and the Sheehys, and his relationship with Owen Sheehy Skeffington, the second is really on what the structures of his thinking. Now, the wild fluctuations, and I think the ones that are least defensible, come towards the end. But
what do you think was going on there?
Well, I think I agree with Dermot Whelan very much, for example, that I would have that this book changed my mind about one thing, and that is about the influence of Burke. I think I wrote somewhere rather impetuously once that in the case of David Thornley, who's a friend of mine, that he had become Isaac Butt and that Conor Cruise O'Brien had become Burke. But the influences, if you like, on the fact, the importance of order, about things that gave way, the Sheehy's coming down. But I'll give you one example of an enormous shift. In the early stages, he mentions, you know, Maurice Goldring has caught a conversation between Sean McEntee and Conor Cruise O'Brien, where he said, our people went down and your people came up. But I do remember I was present in Liberty Hall when he was chosen as the candidate, and he spoke about the sweeping away of the Irish Party. Now, you come on to the later Cruise O'Brien, and in fact, he has a totally polar opposite view. But yes, I don't see that as a weakness.
Sure, he does say, Ronan, that the German real that is, I mean, he challenges O'Brien's reading of 19th century Irish history, especially the view that most Irish Catholics supported constitutional nationalists, that they had no truck at all with the Fenians.
I would agree absolutely with Dermot Whelan about that. I mean, this is another example of black and white. I mean, these things are much more grey. I mean, he asks a very interesting question, Dermot Whelan, of Conor Cruise O'Brien. He says, does his mythologizing and his demonizing, and the way he did that in his historical writing, preclude him from being properly described as a historian? And he speaks about, you know, the extent to which, you know, the counterfactual, he uses the speculative. And there's an extraordinary quotation, many, many extraordinary quotations, where Conor Cruise O'Brien speaks about history as art. Is first of all, history is science, a sedative leading to what he describes as the resignations of agnosticism. Wonderful phrase.
It is.
History as art, on the contrary, as a stimulant which enriches and embitters contemporary conflicts.
Yes.
Now, it's almost there as if, you know, that fact of embitterment is a good thing.
And then there is his defence of Michelet's.
But
I think on Michelet, I think there's an important distinction in there to be made. That is to say that, I mean, he admired Michelet's tendency to express preferences, but the key point being that he felt that did not cloud his judgment. I mean, that's the key notion there, isn't it?
Well, what I think is at stake here, and it helps us understand the loneliness and also the contradictions, is his case for passion. Even in those biographies that have been written about Connor, you know, for example, the Richard Murphy recollections or Patricia Avis's recollections of meeting Connor Cruise O'Brien, in everything he did, there is this sense of not missing one's opportunity to be part of history and to participate with passion, but in one's exercise of rationality in that project, one is going to lose.
But the point
because rationality will never be enough. Yeah. And
the point here is that having preferences is consistent with taking a dispassionate view of things. I mean, this would be...
Oh, yes, of course.
Exactly,
I think that if you take the chapter on Antigone is very interesting. You know, I think it would be unfair to reduce it to say that Conor Cruise O'Brien becomes Creon in the end, because I think it's more complex than that. What I think, if you like, what those of us who walked along with him in...
I mean, ultimately, he was saying at the end, wasn't he, that Antigone, that she represented conservative values, and it was for that reason...
Well, traditional values.
Traditional values, if you like, yes. And it was for that reason that he was being critical of her. Just think about Burke. I don't know if you picked up on this, Ronan, that it seemed to me the influence of Burke and O'Brien was rather Burke's distrust of abstractions. That O'Brien warmed to the concrete, to the, you know, the little platoons and so on.
I think that's true. Again, there's a very interesting phrase where he speaks about nationalism, Dermot Whelan. He says that for Conor Cruise O'Brien, there's no theory.
Yes,
nationalism
yes, right.
consists of the of deeds.
Of that nationalists do,
which is the Burkean point.
Do you go along with that, that was the influence of Burke on him? You know, that he shared with Burke that distrust, Conor did, of abstractions.
Well, I think that what was troublesome for me to discover in Conor Cruise O'Brien, and I wrote in my first collection of poems, I have a poem which is a message for an elder statesman who wants to find himself as a liberal rather than a socialist. You see, social class didn't get in.
Yes.
Now, quite early on O'Brien's writing.
Was this because religion was everything?
I don't know. I think that...
Well, he came from a very bourgeois background.
He came from a very bourgeois background.
Very socially snobbish background.
Yes, and if you...
Snobbish, you're saying.
I kept, as I read the book as well, I kept on thinking of the atmosphere of the dead in it.
Absolutely.
Because it is about families sinking and families rising.
Absolutely.
And there's no doubt whatsoever about it, it is that in that kind of distant and I think arrogant at times view that there was a class that knew better and really the Sheehys and everything that they represented would have in fact ushered in a different kind of Ireland. Now,
I think what you've said about the loneliness and the passion, I think that's actually terribly important. I think it is key. Ernest Gellner, and what you were saying about his disdain, not so much his disdain, he just ignored sociologists. And
in fact, Ernest Gellner,
Gellner makes the point. Yes, he actually writes about his intellectual autism.
Yes,
because
yes,
he absolutely refuses to discuss or to deal with all these people like Benedict Anderson, Gellner himself, all these people.
Can I just come in on that? In fact, Gellner made that point. I interviewed Eric Hobsbawm shortly after I'd read that. And Hobsbawm said about O'Brien that he, apropos that question of autism, that accusation rather, he said O'Brien didn't need to read all of that stuff.
O'Brien certainly believed he didn't need to read.
I'll give you an example of it. I think it was when we were dealing with the bicentenary of the French Revolution, and a number of us were taking part in different panels about the events leading up to the French Revolution, whatever. But Conor would only speak about the terror. And yeah. I remember there was a very famous one in Paris that had Gore Vidal, and it was just going on. And eventually Vidal said, "But Connor, we're discussing the French Revolution." But yeah. Connor was not to be deflected, yeah. because he was putting all of us right, really,
Your former colleague, Liam Dupuis, was saying to me, "Connor doesn't understand economics." People from time to time, I mean, he had no... that was a perspective that didn't impinge very much, did it?
Well, it was in fairness to him, you know, he took one of the best decisions in terms of, to use a word totally out of place, on infrastructure.
when he
got the loans that enabled the telephone system to be expanded, which was an enormous achievement. But what I noticed was interesting about it was, because when I was moving in those circles, I was a very young person, and he would... I have to stress the kindness that was there, and the book actually, Dermot has that
the
in.
Kindness.
The kindness that he showed at times, and the great softness. And I do feel, in a way, that if you put all your eggs in the basket of the intellect, that there is a kind of loneliness associated with that. And if you join that with the background that Connor had, that you then, all around you see a kind of populist excesses, and you see things falling short of what you would have hoped and so forth. So in a way, there is something to the notion, you know, that early phrase he has in one of his essays where he said, too late again, where he has in fact missed a historic moment. There is, in a sense, in which you bring passion. Now, I defend it. I would any day prefer people to have a passion of the intellect, and I don't agree with this nonsense at all, this awful stuff that there is a kind of a pragmatic alternative.
Hold on. I mean, intellectual passion is a reality, isn't it? I mean, one doesn't have to apologise.
No. And desperately missing at the moment.
But what about something that Whelan is concerned with, and it seems to me many people are, and that is the two Conor Cruz O'Briens, the crude polemicist, and you yourself, Ronan, have written about this on the one hand, and the subtle maker of distinctions. Mm. Dennis Donoghue recently, I read a piece he wrote about 30 years ago, in which he said, how can we account for the disparity between the Conor Cruz O'Brien, who writes the kind of vulgar rubbish in the Irish Times, and the much more considered pieces for The Observer?
Well, I think simply the way you can consider that is he's writing for different audiences. If he's writing for an Irish audience, he would take a different view than if he's writing for the London Drawing. I think there's an awful lot of it. There's an awful lot in that you know. And I think, you know, all this business about, I think he was a lonely man. And the business about, Jim Queen is very interesting about how
I think Dennis Donoghue is wrong in that.
Do you think he's wrong?
I
don't want to lose sight of that. How do you mean wrong? That you don't see all that difference between the two kinds of writing he's talking about.
No, I defend the right to move easily between several forms of style, and I think I'm thinking of Dennis Donoghue writing about, for example, reading and whatever.
But I think it tells us more about Dennis Donoghue's stiffness than Conor Cruz O'Brien's limitations. No, it is not a difference of style, though. It's the difference between the willingness to make distinctions and reservations and qualifications.
I don't think you can estimate it like that. I don't think it. This is kind of an argument that's more appropriate to knitting, I think, than literary criticism.
Roland, that's extremely unfair and inaccurate, my lady. I mean, surely there's a hell of a difference between a writing that allows for qualifications and for subtlety of positions.
No, I think Michael is right on this. I think there is a difference. I mean, I'm very conscious.
There is a difference in what?
In style.
Yes.
If I were writing an article for Irish Historical Studies.
Yes, there may
I'm
be.
I'm not going to use the kind of language.
What I'm arguing is there's all the difference in the world between crude polemicism, surely, and a kind of more disinterested look.
To be more disciplined about it, I'd say this. One of the great strengths of Conor Cruz O'Brien's contribution is as a public intellectual. Now, there are some of us who worked in the different disciplines who also wrote and acted in the public space. That what I'm really saying about it is that Dennis Donohue has a slightly different perspective on it. But I think you have to acknowledge in many cases that it is part of, if you like, the morality of the communication itself, that you structure your discourse to the people to the audience.
I'm very distrustful incidentally of that phrase public intellectual. I mean, at what point does intellectual decide that he or she is a public person and is behaving like a public person? I think it unquestionably.
No, the argument is about the argument of what I mean by there are people like Arendt and I mean Cruz O'Brien and others.
There's a point here that Dermawhelan talks about the warping effects of his brush with Irish nationalism, that it would disfigure his entire intellectual cosmos, to use his phrase, that in somehow it infected the rest of his writing.
I think it goes back to Burke and his attitude to violence, the relationship between legitimacy and violence.
Do you agree, by the way, that was the core of what he was about?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
But, I mean, the point is that, you know, his concern for legitimacy, he sought to deny the validity of violence. Now, I have no difficulty with that. I would absolutely deny the validity of violence. But that got him into a position
where
he wrote history where he absolutely denied that violence worked in certain circumstances.
Well, that's
just
what
let me read you one sentence.
Yes.
He saw absolutely no reason why the independence on offer in the treaty could not equally well have developed into sovereign independence for the same area without the need for any violent uprising. Likewise, rejected the claim that independent Ireland owes its existence to territorial terrorism and to negotiation by the British government of that time with the terrorists. Basically, our state owes its existence to the known and attested demand of a majority of its inhabitants for self-government and the recognition by Britain of the legitimacy of that demand.
See,
that is simply wrong.
I think it is wrong.
That's absolutely wrong.
And I have to confess an interest in it all because my father was in the War of Independence, my uncles were. They were in different sides in the Civil War. And one of the things that I have actually found difficult about that kind of thinking is the suggestion that they should have had a rationalised agenda to justify their actions. Many of my father's case were shop boys and people who were apprentices and so forth, and they were as entitled to a moral emotional response to the deprivation of land and the deprivation of opportunities.
There is a just war tradition.
There are cases for there's a strong case for resisting injustice, and this is the point. You see, this model worked backwards to suggest that everything could have been achieved in a parliamentary way that would have left the Sheehys running a better Ireland. I powerfully reject it.
The reason why that is so is because the British did not recognise and give the Irish parliamentary democracy. British parliamentary democracy failed Irish constitutional nationalism.
Yes.
So you're saying that O'Brien was an absolute...
You couldn't get your way except
O'Brien,
by violence.
O'Brien was an absolutist on this, you're saying, in his total condemnation of violence.
I don't think he's an absolutist. I think what he has is that he has several shifting absolutisms. You must remember that there are times when Connor changes. Mm. Like, for example, he doesn't ever deny his participation in anti-Vietnam demonstrations in New York. But it's after that he comes back to Liberty Hall in 69. And remember his phrase in 1969. He's speaking about his He said, this kind of politics, this is referring to conservative Gombin politics, will be all swept away. And he makes an explicit reference
to
the Irish Party. I'm there listening to this, and I said, this is interesting. So then he moves on, and then there's a longer interview much later in which he speaks about what Irish foreign policy will be when you have a Labour-led government. Then he changes ground, of course. But we went to the North together. May I say one thing that he had above all else? He had extraordinary courage. I remember at a parliamentary meeting one day, there was an apprentice boys' march about to take place, and he said to me, "I'm thinking of going up, Michael D, and confronting them." He said, "Would you like to come?" The fact is that he had extraordinary courage, and his contribution, really, and it's a very valuable one, is a provocation of all the taken for granted. That's kind right, of assumptions that were around the place, and not only in politics and history, but also in literature. Mm. I happen to admire much of what he's been writing about Yeats, and I think that I disagree actually with his construction on the Antigone theme, but I think it's powerful work.
Yes, I think for me the finest writing was the collection of written under Maria Cross, collection of
the
essays,
Catholic writers,
written about. And again, you see the kind of fineness of the mind when he says, "I'm not talking about the Catholic imagination, but the imagination of specific Catholic writers and so on." A point that Whelan makes is that his need to win the argument meant he overlooked evidence that wasn't congenial, because you've been saying that to some degree, that
absolutely.
He did.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
He had to win, that's important.
He had to win. He absolutely had to win. And I think, not just, I mean, Michael D has spoken about his physical courage, but he also showed, I think, huge moral courage.
Yes.
And that's ultimately the importance of States of Ireland. Yeah. I mean, historically, in a historical context, States of Ireland is the hugely important book. The best, I think, or definition of his legacy is a phrase that Diarmuid Whelan quotes from Seamus Heaney, where he speaks about Conor Cruise O'Brien creating some sort of clarity in Southerners' thinking about the Protestant community in the North. And it's not enough for people simply to say, "Ah, they're all Irishmen," when some Northerners actually spit at the word Irishman. There is in O'Brien a kind of obstinate insistence on facing up to that kind of reality. And that's really his contribution.
Before we go, just your poem, Michael, perhaps you'd read it that you wrote.
Well, I wrote it a long time ago. Conor, I changed my mind too. But it was based on things we had done together. But I wrote it in 1992. Message for an elder statesman who defined himself once as a liberal rather than a socialist. I remember it well those days late in 1969, when behind badly scrawled banners we marched together, and you joined us marching more slowly, and we, respecting your age, slowed our tread. But now our demands forgotten. Be careful, elder statesman, how deeply you trample our banners into the gutter.
We've been discussing Conor Cruise O'Brien, Violent Notions, by Diarmuid Whelan, published by Irish Academic Press. My thanks to Ronan Fanning and Michael D. Higgins. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie. Till next week, bye-bye.